We learned this week that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin has agreed to form a joint fundraising venture with Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. Wisconsin is one of four states so far to have a state Democratic Party enter that kind of deal with the Clinton campaign. It's a strategy our next guest says isn't necessarily uncommon in American politics. The timing of the announcement months before the party actually nominates a candidate is a bit unusual, though. All this comes at an interesting time for campaign finance, as recent Supreme Court rulings have made it easier for more money to flow into elections. How's this all going to play out in the coming months? Ken Mayer is with us now. He's a professor of political science at UW-Madison who studies campaign finance. Ken, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Good to be with you.
So let's start with some background. This concept of joint fundraising sounds simple, but it's campaign finance law, so I assume it's not. What are we talking about here?
The federal law allows candidates, interest groups, basically any type of political committee to enter into joint fundraising agreements, which essentially allow them to raise money together. And the key feature of these agreements is that there has to be a written agreement between the organizations about allocating the money that they raise. They're actually very common. There were over 500 of them in 2014, another 500 in 2012. So they are a routine part of the campaign finance landscape. What makes this a little unusual and what had people scratching their heads is why the Democratic Party, the state parties, agreed to do this with the Clinton campaign even before the nomination process had even kicked off formally. I mean, we're still 5 months out of the first primaries and caucuses. And it turns out we know a little bit more now than we did yesterday. The Washington Post reported that the agreement between Clinton and these various parties and the DNC allows them to raise money now, but it will be spent in the general election on whomever gets the nomination. So it doesn't appear, based on the reports, that this is anything that's going to happen before the nomination is settled.
Right, because some of the gut reaction from some people was, wait, is this an early anointing of a candidate by these four state Democratic parties? Maybe not, but at least in this sense, it isn't just benefiting the Hillary Clinton campaign itself.
Right. So again, the unusual element here is the timing. And the state parties and the DNC have all made it clear that they would sign agreements with any candidate. Again, the Post reported that the DNC would like to have these agreements signed with all 50 state parties. So at this point, it really is a fundraising mechanism that allows the candidates and the state parties and national parties to raise money together. It begins to look a little bit like what soft money looked like in the 1990s, but it's not unusual.
And it sounds like very clearly this money wouldn't be spent on behalf of Hillary Clinton's primary campaign, which would, I assume, really tick off other Democrats in the party who opposed her.
It certainly, based on the reports, and I haven't seen the agreement, but that seems to be correct.
Now, you mentioned this isn't new. Can you go back a little bit to where this got started?
Well, as best as I can tell, that the first notice that I found in federal law for joint fundraising committees were in the 1970s. So I trace it back to the Federal Election Campaign Act. And what it allows is there are all kinds of complicated questions that arise when candidates and their supporters or a corporate political action committee that also belongs to a trade association, that the relationships between groups and candidates and among groups are very complicated and the arrows go in all different directions. And this allows different groups to cooperate in raising money. They can't do anything with the money that they wouldn't otherwise be permitted to do under federal law. So it's not as if this joint fundraising committee between the Clinton campaign and the DNC or the Wisconsin Democratic Party can morph into a super PAC in which individuals can give unlimited amounts of money. The amounts of money that individuals can give to the candidates and to the parties are still limited by federal law. But it's a way of leveraging and making it easier for candidates and parties to work together.
But those amounts are limited less than they used to be now, right? Because we've talked about, while individual donation limits are still in place, the aggregate donation limit, if I want to donate to 50 or 100 candidates, that aggregate donation limit is not what it used to be, or is not there now, right?
That's correct. Prior to a Supreme Court decision from last year, McCutcheon versus the Federal Election Commission, there was an aggregate limit of about $120,000 or so that an individual could give to all federal candidates and all federal committees, parties, interest groups, and so forth. And what McCutcheon did, what that decision did, is eliminate those caps. And so an individual can give the maximum amount to a candidate, it's about $2,600, $5,000 to a political action committee, and varying levels, and in a few tens of thousands of dollars to parties. But they can do that to an unlimited number of groups. And there's an appendix to the McCutcheon decision where Stephen Breyer, Justice Breyer, mapped out some possibilities in which an individual could give millions of dollars to all of the candidates, parties, and interest groups in the course of a single cycle. And that's what I think is being leveraged here, that an individual who has given money to candidates and to parties can give them to as many parties and candidates as he or she wants.
Talking to UW political scientist Ken Mayer right now about campaign finance. Specifically, we're starting off with this joint finance agreement, joint fundraising agreement, I should say, between Hillary Clinton and the state Democratic parties in Wisconsin and three other states. A fairly common arrangement, he says. We'll get into some wider campaign finance issues in a bit. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your concerns and your questions about how all this works. One question, people have been doing this a long time. It's got to benefit somebody. Do candidates make out well? Does this work out well for state parties or the other parties involved in these joint fundraising agreements?
Well, it seems to me that when a party enters into one of these arrangements, that it benefits the party because they are the candidates can raise as much money as they need to, or as they like. But it depends entirely on the nature of the agreement. For example, in 2008. The McCain campaign, the presidential campaign, entered into a joint fundraising agreement with the National Party, but about 95% of that money that was raised went to the McCain campaign, and only a few percentage points went to the party. So it all depends on the allocation formula, again, which has to be written, but I've never seen one of these agreements, so I don't know what the allocation formula is.
We'll go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Daniel is on the line with us in Madison. Daniel, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Daniel?
Okay, so I get the point that was made by the about this arrangement being more to likely set aside money for the general election rather than to help a particular candidate, the primaries. I understand. I'm wondering if the agreement made might have some bearing on a candidate, in this case Hillary Clinton's, access to state donor information that her operation might not otherwise have, giving her an advantage maybe in that way that another candidate, say Martin O'Malley or Bernie Sanders, might not get if they don't enter into such an arrangement.
Well, interesting, Daniel. Do we know anything about how that information sharing might work in a deal like this, even if we don't know the specifics of this deal?
Well, that's an interesting question. There would be nothing that would prohibit a state party from turning that information over in any event, because parties and candidates can do lots of things together. Without having seen the agreement, I don't know whether that's part of it. I suspect, just based on the contours of what parties and candidates do, that's not a central reason why they're doing it. If the state party wanted to give her the information, they could do it even without a joint fundraising agreement, I believe. And there may be reasons for parties to be a little bit cautious about that because they want to maintain control of that for their own purposes and make sure that their donor base doesn't get tapped out, giving all the money to candidates and there's nothing left over for the state party. But that you get into the weeds very deeply, very quickly when you're dealing with these kinds of issues.
For a national campaign, say a presidential campaign, you hear about, you know, fundraising visits often to coasts, places with lots of wealthy people. Is Wisconsin really on the map when it comes to national fundraising?
Milwaukee is a little bit. We are in the orbit of Chicago, and so frequently what might happen is a Democratic candidate wants to come to Chicago and raise some money, and they'll do a toe tap in Milwaukee to pick up a little bit more. I think it has more to do, the candidates raise money where they find the money. So for a Democratic candidate, it's New York, Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Chicago. It's the big cities, which is where the most people are and where you have concentrations of wealth. And for Republicans, it's the same sort of thing, Dallas, Houston, the the big cities. Fundraising is a little bit different than the Electoral College strategy, so a candidate will be coming to Wisconsin in the course of the general election campaign, not so much to raise money, but because Wisconsin is likely to be in play.
We're talking with Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, talking about campaign finance in the presidential election, a starting point, this joint fundraising venture reached between candidate Hillary Clinton and Wisconsin's Democratic Party, along with three other states. And bigger picture, we'll get into how campaign finance is playing out so far in this election cycle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this joint fundraising venture idea this early, before any votes have been cast at caucuses or primaries? When it comes to campaign finance and money in this election cycle, what questions do you have? What hopes and fears do you have as to the role money will play in the presidential race 2016? Call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking now with Ken Mayer, professor of political science at UW-Madison, looking at campaign finance and the presidential race, this joint financing venture reached between presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and our state's Democratic Party, and more generally, how campaign finance is playing out so far in this election cycle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts on this deal we've been talking about and on money in politics and the presidential race in general? Call 800-642-1234. 1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, Ken, we've got a new landscape, a lot of people are saying, with recent Supreme Court decisions on money in politics. What's been the big story so far as we approach primary season?
Well, the big story is that apart from individual contribution limits to candidates, the federal campaign finance landscape has been completely deregulated. That we're now in a situation where individuals and corporations, although corporations tend not to do a lot of this, but individuals and corporations can make unlimited contributions to independent groups. There's no limit to the number of contributions an individual can make to candidates. The proliferation of tax-exempt groups, 501c3s and c4s, and the interlocking relationships among these groups makes it very difficult to track who is ultimately giving the money, where it's coming from. So we have essentially deregulated, or the Supreme Court has deregulated the process, and it's a new kind of world. Just to give one example of what the practical consequences are, there are 17 Republican candidates for the Republican nomination. A couple of them are essentially out of money. There are reports that Rick Perry in particular has stopped paying his staffers because they have been unable to raise significant amounts of money. But he has a super PAC that has $10 million in the bank. So even though he can't pay his supporters and may not be able to pay for a campaign plane, if it gets to that point, this super PAC, which is independent functionally, although there are questions about how ironclad those separations are, he could be on the air and be continuing to run. And that's going to be, I think, a pattern for lots of candidates who 20 years ago or even 10 years ago would have been forced to drop out, but they're still going to stick around.
Well, to that issue, a lot of eyes are on Wisconsin and our Supreme Court decision on coordination. Now, is that, if that were a precedent, we limits on campaign coordination between candidates and outside groups has been deregulated somewhat here. Would that affect a situation with a super PAC, though, like Rick Perry's that you just mentioned and his campaign? Could they work together, essentially spend from over there to over here for the candidate?
The short answer is no, because that Supreme Court decision only dealt with state law. That then they interpreted the federal constitution to allow certain sorts of things. There's some, I think that ruling was incorrect, and there's some chance that it will be appealed to the Supreme Court. But that has no bearing on federal activities, so which is governed by federal law, which prohibit those kinds of coordinations. Now, there are groups that are seeking to have the coordination rules overturned at the federal level, but we're not there yet.
And also, that's the state one, I think, was issue advocacy groups, not super PACs that directly said vote for or vote against.
Right.
So that's a little different, too.
So the old rule was that the first question that you asked is, were you coordinating? If you were coordinating, then everything you did was a contribution, even if it was issue advocacy, advocacy, it didn't matter. And what the Wisconsin Supreme Court said is that's the wrong order, that the first thing you need to ask is it issue advocacy or express advocacy. And if it's issue advocacy, it's entirely outside the scope of regulation, which is a novel and, I think, incorrect reading of the constitutional provisions about campaign finance.
Let's go back to a caller as we talk campaign finance with UW-Madison political scientist Ken Mayer. We've got Rick on the line at 800-642-1234. Rick calling from Green Bay. Rick, hi.
Hi, Ken, I have a question. Is there a maximum dollar amount now that we're in the era of essentially unlimited spending beyond which the candidates get no bang for their buck?
That is an incredibly interesting question. There's no easy answer to that. One of the things we do know is that there are diminishing returns, that the difference between, say, $100 and $10 million is huge. The difference between $10 million and $20 million is significantly less, and so that the curve flattens out. On the other hand, there are, and you also have the issue that the more voters you're going after, it becomes harder to communicate with and to mobilize the more marginally connected voters. Having said that, there are still things like get out the vote drives and voter contacts that are enormously labor intensive. That you spend more money, you can do more of them. Now, again, it's likely there that the effect of the marginal effect of an additional dollar decreases as the amounts go up. But I don't think we are close to at least the recognition among the people who are spending the money that that we are at that point. I think part of what's driving this is a classic arms race dynamic where it may not be in your interest to spend the extra $10 or, in this case, $100 million, but if you don't spend it and the other side does, they win, they are better off, and so you both spend the $100 million and it essentially amounts to a push.
So we're not at a point where a candidate offered a campaign donation is going to say, no, we're good.
No. The demand for money is pretty close to infinite. What you can productively do with that probably goes down, but I don't think anybody knows where that inflection point actually is.
You mentioned specifically the McCutcheon U.S. Supreme Court decision earlier. Citizens United is something that people are still talking about a lot. How are we seeing that affect this year's election cycle?
Well, I actually think there's another federal court decision that is actually playing a bigger role in this dynamic than Citizens United. That was the case in 2010 where the Supreme Court held that corporations can't be prohibited from spending money on express advocacy. But there was another case at about the same time called Speech Now versus the Federal Election Commission, which dealt with the there was a group that challenged the contribution limits to independent groups. So prior to that, if an individual wanted to give money to an independent group, there were contribution limits. And what Speech Now did, it was an appeals court that was that the Supreme Court refused to review. That did away with individual contribution limits. That's why Sheldon Adelson, other folks, George Soros, the Steyers, that they, you can now give a $10, $50, $100, $200 million contribution to a super PAC, to an independent group, as long as it is independent of the campaign, the brakes are completely off.
And that's a case where one donor can sustain you in a primary campaign.
That's correct. And you could have an individual who commits to you, again, as long as they're independent, but they can continue to spend money on your behalf. They can't give it to you. You can't use it to fund campaign activities. But given the amount of money that is spent on advertising, it could sustain a campaign pretty significantly.
Now let's throw a complete hypothetical out here for you. Say you've got a really rich person who decides they want to run for president and use some of their own money. Well, I'm talking about Donald Trump, obviously. Put a lot of their own money into it. How do campaign laws, campaign finance laws, affect self-funded campaigns?
The laws have never applied to self-funded campaigns. This goes back to Buckley versus Valeo, a 1976 Supreme Court decision where they held that you cannot limit the amount of money that an individual spends on his or her own campaign. And the reasoning is that, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, the only permissible reason for regulating campaign finance is to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption. An individual spending money on his own behalf or her own behalf can't be corrupted because there's nothing external to that. And so individuals can spend as much as they want And this is why Trump could self-fund his campaign. It probably will not self-fund it all because he will be able to attract some money. But if he wanted to spend $1 billion running for president, he could.
It's impossible to corrupt ourselves. That's a very philosophical argument.
Well, that's the rationale. There are other reasons why that's a bad thing, I think, because it tends to distort the types of people who can run for office. But that's not really a policy issue. It's, as you put it, it's a philosophical issue, not so much a legal one.
So what are you looking for? What are you watching in the months leading up to, you know, actual votes being cast in Iowa, New Hampshire, and elsewhere when it comes to money and politics?
Well, it's difficult to say because as I tell my students, tell reporters that we've actually worked out pretty well the dynamics of a two-candidate race. You can predict what candidates are doing. It starts to fall apart with a three-candidate race with 17 candidates. It's essentially Brownian motion. There's no way to predict what's going to happen when someone drops. It's essentially chaos. And so the effects, I think, will be that a lot of candidates will stick around longer than they otherwise would have if this was 2004 or 1996.
Is it ever a case where a party is worried, hey, if we blow all our donated money in primary campaigns, we're not going to have enough juice left in the general election? Or are people keeping at least some powder dry for the actual event there?
Well, again, it depends on whether we're talking about the campaigns, the candidate organizations, or the super PACs. If it's the candidate organizations, you do run into problems if you have individuals who have maxed out. You can't go back to them for more money. With 17 candidates, I think there may be some issues where the pool of potential donors has been thinned out somewhat. But that doesn't have anything to do with the super PACs. As long as you have wealthy individuals of relatively small number who are willing to commit to a particular candidate, that seems to be less more inelastic.
Ken, as always, thanks for joining us and explaining the finer points of campaign finance law.
It's always a pleasure.
That's Ken Mayer. He's professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us to talk about campaign finance in the ongoing presidential race.